Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CoeAndReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CoeAndReview.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 9th of January, 2024, from the news section. Elgin. Family pay tribute to bus driver killed in incident. This article is written by Lucy Jackson. The family of a bus driver who died following an incident in Elgin have paid tribute to the kindest and most dedicated husband and father. Keith Rowlinson, 58, died in Elgin, Moray, on February the 2nd, following an incident on St Giles Road in the town. A 15-year-old boy, who cannot be named for legal reasons, was arrested and appeared at Elgin Sheriff Court, charged with murder on Monday following the death. He did not enter a plea and was committed for further examination and remanded in custody. In a statement released by police, Rowlinson's family said, "On Friday, February the 2nd, the kindest, most dedicated and loving husband and father was taken from us. Our world has been shattered. I cannot see us ever getting over our loss of our rock. We would like to ask for privacy at this time to deal with the loss without intrusion." Rowlinson was pronounced dead shortly after he was taken to Dr. Gray's hospital in Elgin after the incident. Detective Inspector Gavin Fleming of Aberdeen CID said, "Our thoughts are very much with Keith's family, and we are providing them with support at what is a very difficult time for them. They have asked for their privacy to be respected." A spokeswoman for Stagecoach North Scotland said earlier, "We are shocked and saddened by this news, and our immediate thoughts are with the family and friends of our driver, who has sadly passed away. We are doing everything we can to support our colleagues and our driver's family, as well as assisting the police in their investigation." That article was written by Lucy Jackson. This is from The National on Friday, the 9th of January, 2024, from the comments section. Liz Truss's new pressure group shows her inability to feel shame. This article is written by Wee Ginger Doug. You'd think that after her disastrous stint as Prime Minister, which crashed the British economy and saw her outlasted by a lettuce, Liz Truss would have gone away, crawled under a rock in shame, and not come out until lettuces had evolved sentience. However, one thing that the Tories have not evolved is the ability to feel shame, or indeed compassion, humanity or decency. Truss still affects to believe that her government was brought down by an international cabal of woke lefties in the Bank of England and the international money markets, those well-known branches of the Socialist Workers' Party, and not by her own lies and incompetence. Truss has now launched a new Conservative pressure group in order to force the Conservative Party further to the right, because the real problem with the Tories is they're not fascist enough. Truss's new pressure group is organised and funded by the same shadowy, dark, money-funded far-right think tanks based in Tufton Street, in a posh part of Westminster in London, that were responsible for Truss's suicidal approach to the economy. Funded by right-wing multimillionaires, these groups are parasites on politics, which disguise themselves as the voice of the people. True to form, Truss's new organisation has called itself Popular Conservatism, with the unfortunate short form PopCon, which the organisers doubtless thought was a shrewd branding tactic to make themselves sound hip and modern. The founding conference of this new group was held in Tufton Street because organisers want to demonstrate that they are in tune with the voices of the common man and woman in the street, as long as that street is Tufton Street. In fact, PopCon sounds very like one of those online scams, which entitles people to send off a large amount of money for seats to Taylor Swift's world tour, only to eventually receive a flimsy plastic stool with Taylor Swift World Tour stamped on the seat. Liz Truss's PopCon is a very similar sort of scam, promising solutions to the problems of ordinary people when all that will really happen is they end up poorer while a wealthy, shadowy sociopath rakes in the cash. The central thesis of PopCon is that despite being in government for 70 of the last 100 years, the Tories have no power, because the legal system, the media, the Environment Agency, Natural England, the Office of Budget Responsibility, the Post Office, the Bank of England, and international currency traders are all woke lefties who conspire to do down the common people that only the far right funded by billionaires can properly represent. The conference was addressed by that spokesman for the common people, Jacob Rees-Mogg, and the intellectual giant of modern conservatism, 30p Lee Anderson. Anderson took to the stage to demand more fracking and for coal mines to be reopened, claiming that coal is a sustainable energy resource because it used to be trees. Rampant climate science denial is very much on brand for the Tufton Street groups. Coal took 250 million years to form, which is still quicker than the waiting time for a dental appointment in NHS England. Next up, they'll be claiming that it's perfectly fine to pump England's river full of untreated sewage because human excrement is organic. It is a sign of how epically unfit for purpose that the Westminster system has become that someone as dense and callous as Lee Anderson got promoted to a position of power and influence, instead of being left to rant about immigrants while nursing a pint in a lonely dark corner of a dingy pub. This is a man who has no idea at all of the difference between renewable and non-renewable resources, but still thinks he is qualified to give a key speech on sustainability. But then that's quite appropriate for a conference supposedly about kick-starting the British economy, whose figurehead is Liz Truss, a woman who almost kicked the British economy to death. Rishi Sunak's callousness on full display with Piers Morgan. Still, it is quite remarkable that Lee Anderson is still eclipsed this week by Rishi Sunak in the Tory facepalm stakes. Sunak has come in for widespread criticism for accepting a bet of £1,000 from the equally odious Piers Morgan that asylum seekers would be deported to Rwanda before the next general election. At Prime Minister's Questions today, SNP Westminster leader Stephen Flynn demanded that Sunak apologise for a demeaning and dehumanising stunt, saying, "The public are used to the Tories gambling on the lives of others." Sunak dodged the question. Following Sunak's decision to withdraw cost-of-living support for low-income families, even as the Tories tout the possibility of tax cuts in next month's budget, the SNP leader asked Sunak, "What does he think makes him look more out of touch? Gambling £1,000 or claiming the cost of living is getting better?" £1,000 is loose change to Sunak, but a fortune to low-income families struggling to make ends meet. This is a man who is so far up his own fundamental that he thought it was okay to make a cheap jibe about transgender women while the mother of murdered transgender teenager Brianna Jay was visiting Parliament and expected in the public gallery. The Tories are determined to pursue their culture wars, even at the expense of the bereaved. It was appalling, even by the crass low standards of the Conservative Party. Sunak was later asked by another Labour MP to apologise for his remark. He ignored the request. Independence poll shows SNP need to bat off Labour gains. The latest opinion poll has shown that support for the independents is at 53%, while also showing that the SNP would pick up 40 seats at the next general election, while Labour would secure 13 and the Tories just 2. The Ipsos poll places the SNP on 39% vote share, with vote to Labour on 32% and the Conservatives trailing far behind on 14%. The poll highlights how important it is for the SNP to motivate pro-independent supporters to turn out and vote for it at the next general election. And that article was written by Wee Ginger Doug. This is from The National on Friday the 9th of January 2024, from the news section. Major supermarket launches bottle return scheme in Scotland. This article is written by Steph Braun. Lidl has launched a pilot bottle return scheme in all of its stores across Scotland's largest city. The major supermarket chain will roll out the initiative across 21 stores in Glasgow, where shoppers can enjoy unlimited cash rewards in return for empty PET plastic and aluminium drinks containers via in-store reverse vending machines. PET, polyethylene terephthalate, is a type of clear, strong and lightweight plastic which is 100% recyclable, and you can usually find a symbol on plastic containers if it is this type. Shoppers will receive a 5p reward for each eligible item that they return to a store, which can either be redeemed against their shopping or donated to Lidl's charity partner, the STV Children's Appeal. There is no cap on the number of items that can be returned, and the machines will accept qualifying bottles and cans purchased from any retailer, as long as they are clean and uncrushed. The move comes after Scottish Government was forced to delay the introduction of its deposit return scheme until late 2025, with ministers accusing the UK government of deliberately sabotaging the plans. Lorna Slater, who was in charge of implementing the scheme, said a decision by the UK government to bar the Scottish government from including glass in its scheme meant it was no longer feasible in its current form. The inclusion of glass in the scheme had been improved by every party in the Scottish Parliament, including the Conservatives. Unlike the Scottish Government's plans, Lidl's bottle return scheme does not place a deposit on the retail price of the original product. Richard Bourne's Chief Commercial Officer at Lidl GB said, "We're on a mission to eliminate all unnecessary waste, and with over 95% of our own brand packaging now recyclable, reusable or refillable, we've been making great progress. We know that Lidl shoppers share this passion, and we hope that utilising this infrastructure, which might otherwise have been left dormant, will help to make recycling their cans and bottles even more convenient for them. With our extra incentive thrown in, and no cap on the number of items that can be recycled, it's a win-win for all." It's anticipated that the pilot will result in a minimum 10.5 tonnes of plastic and aluminium material being recycled each month. The material will be retained and used to create new plastic and aluminium products. The machines will accept single-use drinks packaging made from PET or aluminium that are 100 ml to 3 litres in size and have a readable barcode to scan at the point of donation. Dairy items such as HDPE, that's high-density polyethylene, plastic milk or yoghurt drinks, Tetra Pak, paper-based cartons, glass or pouches are not eligible for return. That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 9th of January 2024 from the news section. Police seize £1.1 million worth of drugs in bust at Scottish port. This article is written by Xander Eliards. Police have made an arrest after a car stopped at a Scottish port was found to be carrying more than £1 million worth of drugs. Officers said that a significant quantity of cannabis with a potential street value of £1.1 million had been seized at the Loch Ryan port in Cairn Ryan. A car was stopped at around 12:20 p.m. on Wednesday and found to be carrying the illicit drugs. Police say a 32-year-old man has been arrested and charged in connection with the incident. Police Scotland said it is committed to removing illegal substances from our communities and will take all measures to disrupt those involved. Anyone with concerns about drugs in their community can contact Police Scotland via 101 or calling Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111. That's 0800 555 111. That article was written by Xander Eliards. This is from The National on Friday the 9th of January 2024. From the culture section. Refugee musicians visit Scottish National Park for track inspiration. This article is written by Adam Robertson. A group of asylum seekers and refugees visited a Scottish National Park to help with inspiration for a concert with Gaelic folk rock group DLU in March. Members of the Glasgow Barons visited Loch Lomond and the Trossachs National Park on Tuesday to learn about the impact of the climate emergency, Scottish identity, and the benefits of connecting with nature. The group is made up of people from countries including Ukraine and Iran, who had little experience out with Glasgow since arriving in Scotland. Rangers guided the group along the forest trail from Balmahar, demonstrating the importance of Scotland's rainforests for nature and climate, while capturing sounds and colours of their environment for inspiration. Artistic director of the Glasgow Barons, Paul McAllenden, said, "Musicians in exile have been sharing their musical voices across Scotland's communities over 5 years and sang about our climate crisis at COP26. Now, for the first time, we're connecting directly with Scotland's natural heritage to see firsthand how the world is changing on our doorstep." Chief Executive of the National Park, Gordon Watson, added, "It is always hugely rewarding to see people enjoying, valuing, and helping us look after the National Park, and particularly in this instance, where it's something the group haven't had a chance to experience before. Removing barriers to help people from all backgrounds to connect with nature within the National Park is a key objective in our National Park Partnership Plan. Seeing this group reap the benefits while also helping them to talk about the impact of the climate emergency on nature with their community has been a brilliant project to be involved in." Since 2018, Glasgow Barons has seen more than 60 musicians take part in the Musicians in Exile Community Project. The forthcoming performance, inspired by their visit to the National Park, will take place on March the 16th at 7:30 p.m. as part of the Govan Music Festival. That article was written by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Friday the 9th of January 2024 from the news section. World Cycling Championships brought major boost to Scottish economy. This article is written by Adam Robertson. The 2023 UCI World Championships in Glasgow brought a £205 million boost to the Scottish economy, a new report has revealed. Held over 11 days in August, the cycling event combined 13 different disciplines for the first time, forming the biggest cycling event in history. The UCI has now published a report carried out by professional services firm EY, which tells of the extremely positive impact the event had for Scotland. In addition to the significant £205 million boost to the economy, the championships created 5,285 jobs in a year and brought an investment of £6 million across Scotland's 32 local authorities. Commenting on the report, UCI President David Lapartient hailed the impact of the event. The 2023 UCI Cycling World Championships in Glasgow and across Scotland was an unprecedented success at every level, he said. As the EY report shows, this success extends beyond sport to the economy, tourism, and sustainable development. An event like the one we experienced in August 2023 leads to long-term benefits for the host communities and their residents. The report suggested that the championships brought nearly a million spectators to Scotland, 90,000 of which came from outside the UK. In terms of TV, more than 200 million hours of racing was watched on TV by fans around the world. The UCI is planning to host a similar combined world championships every 4 years, with the next coming in 2027. It will take place in France's Alpine Haute-Savoie department. That article was written by Adam Robertson.
This is from The National on Monday, 12th February 2024. From the Politics section. BBC, Stephen Flynn rejects presenter's claim about ceasefire call. By Adam Robertson. Stephen Flynn has rejected a suggestion from a BBC presenter that there is only a cigarette paper between his party's stance on a ceasefire and that of Labour and the Conservative Party. The SNP Westminster leader has already written to both the Prime Minister and the opposition leader, urging them to change course and back an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. It comes after Israel carried out airstrikes in Rafah, with dozens believed to have been killed, health officials have said. Speaking to the BBC's Good Morning Scotland, Flynn was asked about his letter, but was asked if there was any real difference between the SNP's position and Labour and the Tories. Host Laura Maxwell said there was a cigarette paper between where you are and they are, a suggestion which Flynn rejected. No, I'm afraid there's not. There's much more than that. There's a chasm, and it's because of the language which is being used, he said. The language which is being used, incidentally, as you've outlined there, by both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, effectively gives a veto on our foreign policy to both Hamas and Benjamin Netanyahu, neither of whom are interested in the lives, the safety of civilians in Palestine. Both Foreign Secretary David Cameron and Starmer have previously expressed support for a sustainable ceasefire. However, both have faced criticism for their stance on the matter, with Starmer facing a rebellion from more than 50 of his MPs back in November, who voted with the SNP in calling for a ceasefire. Asked if neither Netanyahu or Hamas were interested in what UK politicians have to say, Flynn replied, "Hamas and Benjamin Netanyahu would be interested in what British politicians say. Firstly, Israel would be interested because we, of course, sell arms to Israel, and we should stop selling arms to Israel whilst they are conducting acts of violence against Palestinian civilians. We also have a say because we are members of the United Nations. Up till now, we have not voted in favour of a ceasefire. We should be voting in favour of a ceasefire. We're also a permanent member of the UN Security Council. So, yes, what we say does have relevance. but it also has relevance in the wider region because over the course of recent weeks and months, we've now seen bombings in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Yemen. There is regional instability, and we, of course, have a role to play in making sure that regional instability is dissipated and we can get peace. So, of course, they should be interested in what we say, particularly Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government. It's why the UK needs to vote for a ceasefire, and it's why both Keir Starmer and Rishi Sunak have shown cowardice on this matter. That article was by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Monday, 12th February 2024. From the News section. Shetland. Woman found dead and man arrested after disturbance. By Adam Robertson. A man has been arrested after a woman was found dead following a disturbance in Shetland. Police were called to reports of an incident at a house in the village of Sandness just before 5 p.m. on Sunday. The woman was pronounced dead at the scene by emergency services while the man was arrested and taken to hospital for treatment. A spokesperson for Police Scotland said, around 4:55 p.m. on Sunday, February 11th, officers were called to reports of a disturbance in the west of mainland Shetland. Emergency services attended and a woman was pronounced dead at the scene. A man was arrested in connection with the incident and was taken to hospital for treatment to injuries. Officers are not looking for anyone else and inquiries remain ongoing. That article was by Adam Robertson. This is from The National on Monday, 12th February 2024. From the Politics section. Two-fifths of Scotland's older private tenants live in poverty. By Lucy Garcia. A charity has warned that nearly 40% of older private tenants in Scotland are living in poverty, and more than 1 in 10 is scared to ask their landlord for repairs. More than a fifth of older people rent, or 22% in Scotland, with 177,000 in the social rented sector and almost 50,000 in the private rented sector. Some 75,448 older tenants live in poverty, according to research from charity Independent Age, which said there had been an increase in homelessness in the past year and raised fears over the end of the rent rise cap on March 31st. The charity called for greater protections in the upcoming housing bill, which First Minister Humza Yousaf said was a bid to introduce long-term rent controls and new tenant rights, when it was revealed in his first programme for government. The charity's report, Homing In, How to Improve the Lives of Older Scottish Renters, said older renters face a catastrophe if action is not taken, with record rent increases in recent years. It said its research, using a sample of 373 people in Scotland, shows 39% of older private tenants live in poverty, while more than a quarter, or 28%, have less than £200 in disposable income a month after rent. In the last year, 81% said they had faced a rise in rent of up to £50 a month, and there has been a 23% increase in older people experiencing homelessness, up from 891 in 2021-22 to 1,100 in 2022-23. Some 17% of older tenants are afraid their landlord will evict them in the coming year, while 59% said finding a new home would be difficult due to rising rents and requirements such as a ground floor property. Polling found 12% of older private renters feel uncomfortable about raising concerns with their landlord for fear of negative treatment, although 65% of their homes are in a state of disrepair. One man said, "I know if I complain to my landlord, it will get me nowhere but homeless." Another said, "There is a smell of damp in winter. There's a huge opening in the back wall where the boiler is located. The wind whistles into the flat." The charity urged the Scottish Government to introduce rent controls for low-income older private tenants, to create a housing ombudsman, and for advice to be provided on housing services when evictions are served. It also called on the UK Government to commit to increasing the local housing allowance every year so that housing benefit matches rises in local rents. Independent Age Chief Executive Joanna Elson said, "The Scottish Government made positive moves in recent years to protect tenants. But with many of the protections from eviction and rent increases coming to an end soon, we've spoken to many people renting in later life who are absolutely terrified about what will happen over the coming months. The housing bill is a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the Scottish Government to make sure everyone has a home that is affordable, kept to a decent standard, and free from the threat of eviction and homelessness." Tenants' Rights Minister Patrick Harvey said, "Our emergency legislation, including the rent cap, has led the way at a time when rents have been rising across the UK, striking an important balance between protection for tenants and the rights of landlords. We have proposed that from April 1st, all private tenants continue to have an additional protection so they do not face the very sudden rises that could apply if rents were to return to open market rates in one step. We will accompany this with a campaign focusing on private tenants, aimed at increasing awareness of their rights and empowering them to assert these rights if required by accessing the available support. We welcome support from both landlord and tenant bodies in spreading those messages." That article was by Lucy Garcia.
From the National, Tuesday the 13th of February. From the comment section, "Commitment to inclusivity and equality remains unwavering in Scotland," by Karen Adam, MSP. "The Scottish Parliament embarked on a journey to extend a hand of support to one of the most marginalised groups in our society, the transgender community. The passage of the Gender Recognition Reform, GRR, bill was intended as a beacon of progress, illuminating a path towards inclusivity and understanding. This beacon was abruptly extinguished by a block from Westminster, where it utilised Section 35 of the Scotland Act for the first time in history, a move that felt not just like a halting of progress, but also a direct affront to Scottish democracy. The tragic story of Brianna Gay, a vibrant soul taken too soon, serves as a poignant reminder of the stakes at play. Brianna's life and the heinous crime that ended it cast a long shadow, highlighting the real and present dangers faced by transgender individuals daily. The sentencing of her killers brought some measure of justice, but it also opened a broader conversation about hate, societal acceptance, and the role of leaders in shaping public discourse. In a world that too often turns its back on those who dare to live their truth, the vitriol and disdain directed at transgender individuals are not just disappointing, they are profoundly dangerous. It's a stark reminder that our words carry weight, and for those of us in positions of influence, whether in the media or politics, there is a grave responsibility to ensure our rhetoric fosters understanding rather than fear, acceptance rather than division." Last week's remarks by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak in the Commons were, in this context, deeply troubling. To use the identity of a transgender individual as a political punchline, especially in a week marked by the anniversary of Brianna's death and while her mother was there in the House of Parliament, was not just insensitive, it was a failure of leadership. It prompts the question, is there an absence of compassion? a lack of awareness of the impact of such comments? Or has there been desensitization of the consequences perpetrating such rhetoric? The outcry from various quarters, including Nicola Sturgeon's accurately aimed criticism, underscores a collective yearning for a politics that lifts up rather than undermines, that protects rather than exposes to harm. As a member of the Equalities Committee at the Scottish Parliament, it's disheartening to witness these missed opportunities for empathy and leadership. The fight for transgender rights, for people's recognition and safety, is not a culture war to be waged, but a moral need to be championed. In a more just world, Brianna would have been granted the simple dignity of having her death certificate reflect her identity, a gesture of acknowledgement from a society to one of its own. Such actions, small in effort but vast in significance, are the least we owe to individuals who navigate a world that is often unkind to those who dare to defy traditional norms. The blockage of the GRR bill by Westminster, citing concerns over its implications for the Equality Act, was a stark reminder of the fragility of devolved powers and the limitations placed on Scotland's ability to legislate in line with its values. This isn't merely a legal or constitutional dilemma. It's a profound statement about the value we place on human dignity and the lengths we are willing to go to protect it. As we are faced with the choice between regression and progress, silence and advocacy, it becomes clear that the path forward must be paved with an unyielding support for the transgender community. This is not about politics, it's about people, about ensuring that every individual, regardless of how they identify, feels safe, respected and valued. The Prime Minister's refusal to apologise, coupled with the UK Government's stance on Brianna's death certificate, reflects a broader issue within her current political landscape, which is the refusal to acknowledge trans reality. It's a failure to validate and accept all of our society, one that doesn't fit a narrative of heteronormativity. This dissent transcends party lines and political ideologies, pointing to a deeper need for empathy, understanding and, above all, action. In Scotland, our commitment to inclusivity and equality remains unwavering. The setback faced with the GRR bill does not mark the end of our journey, but rather a call to redouble our efforts, stand in solidarity with the transgender community, and continue advocating for a society that recognises the dignity and worth of every individual. The path to equality is fraught with challenges, but it's a path we must walk with our heads held high and our hearts open, guided by the belief that a better world is not just possible, but necessary. The demeanour of Brianna's mother stands as a testament to the potential capacity of us humans for compassion and understanding. Amid her profound grief, she has extended an olive branch of empathy, not just to those who directly wronged her, but also to the families of the individuals responsible for her daughter's death. This remarkable display of forgiveness and kindness, even in the depths of despair, serves as a powerful lesson for us all. It underscores the importance of maintaining our humanity and capacity for understanding, even when faced with the most harrowing of circumstances. Esther Gay's actions remind us that compassion should be the cornerstone upon which we build our interactions and judgments, especially when addressing the complexities surrounding the lives of marginalised communities. Her strength and grace in such a trying time illuminate the path forward for us all, highlighting the profound impact empathy can have in healing divided communities and fostering a more inclusive society. The memory of Brianna Gay is a reminder of the stakes involved, of the lives that hang in the balance. Let us channel our collective outrage not into despair, but into a renewed commitment to fight for a world where everyone, regardless of gender identity, can live without fear, embraced by a society that sees them, hears them and values them. This is the Scotland that I strive for. And that was a comment piece by columnist Karen Adam. From The National, Monday the 12th of February, from the comment section, transphobia had grip at Westminster long before Sunak's PMQ's jibe. This article is by Steve Payton. The week following the sentencing of Brianna Gay's killers was an eye-opener for many, though not for those who have been the target of the political class's culture wars these past 7 years. Suddenly presented with a tangible, physical connection to the consequences of transphobia, many appear to have finally paused and considered that the end of each barb about defining a woman is a human being. Though I won't lie that there is not a bitter feeling in this revelation. On the one hand, the fallout over Rishi Sunak's tasteless jibe in the Commons could be seen as a turning point in how transgender people are discussed by politicians and newspaper columnists. On the other, many who have condemned Sunak's comments as crass have themselves poured poison onto the discourse around trans rights. There feels to have been little reflection on how, over the course of several Conservative prime ministers, transphobic rhetoric has so permeated the halls of Westminster, normalising it to the degree that Sunak felt the need to get the boot in, even as the UK was reeling from the horrific details of Brianna's murder. Lest we forget, this is not Sunak's first foray into cheap transphobia in the chamber. Yet, previously, Keir Starmer remained silent, happy to let it pass while dismissing accusations of transphobia made against his own party. It should not take being presented face to face with the consequences of transphobia for a parliament to consider the language it uses to describe minority groups. Sunak and Starmer both demonstrate the object permanence of a child, one who can't comprehend what lies beyond it with their vision has not ceased to exist, that the targets of their churlish insults can still hear the Prime Minister's ignorant comments and see Starmer's passive acceptance of them. Yet, much of the response has been framed as a watershed moment, with the newsagent's podcast naively opining on the level of transphobia that started to infect British political debate. What does it mean by started to? From 2017 onwards, there has been a steady hate campaign aimed at transgender people that has sought to demonise, dehumanise and misrepresent my community. Research indicates that between 2015 to 22, the mainstream British press was publishing on average 154 articles about trans people every month, with the Daily Mail contributing 5 fresh articles each day during May 2022 alone. You won't be surprised to know that the overwhelming majority of these articles were negative in nature. There is a danger at this moment that many will view Sunak's anti-trans snipe on the day of Brianna's mother, Esther Gray, was in the Houses of Parliament, as an isolated incident. In reality, it is a mark of institutionalised bigotry in the halls of Westminster and the British press. It was under that toxic environment that Brianna Gray was murdered, her killers motivated in part by the same transphobia that is so commonplace in print and Parliament. The Proud Trust, which supports LGBTQ plus young people in Greater Manchester, reported at the weekend that people they work with were feeling frightened, feeling misunderstood. It has reported a spike in the number of young trans people reaching out for help in the wake of recent events. The LGBTQ plus switchboard helpline reported similar jumps in support needs following the murder of Brianna. A similar surge followed the Prime Minister's speech at the Conservative Party conference last October, when Sunak stated, "We shouldn't get bullied into believing that people can be any sex they want to be. They can't. A man is a man and a woman is a woman." It's a comment that reeks of the same themes of Thatcher's infamous "children are being taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay" conference speech in the 1980s. The toxic environment trans people are living under in the UK is real. That means checking over your shoulder at night or planning days out around not having to use any public restrooms for fear of violence. Transphobia hasn't started to infect Westminster. Its roots already grow deep, and I doubt that the British press has any tools to truly reflect on the role they have played in mainstreaming a hate movement, instead choosing to remain bullishly unflinching in the way that only an industry of the privately educated middle class can be. The consequences of years and years of normalised bigotry has fostered an environment where Jeremy Hunt can defend his leader's comments on BBC News without ever getting Brianna's name right, where the Prime Minister is so numb to the idea of transgender people as fellow human beings that he forgets to turn off his practice *** eating grin when talking about a murdered teenager on television and refusing to apologise to Brianna's father for his language. Not that an apology from Sunak would mean anything, not when the policies and programmes of his amoral governments stay the course on segregating trans people further and further from public life. With an election approaching, I have seen nothing that would suggest that either Labour or the Tories have any real interest in tackling the institutional issues that have flourished under their leadership. Nor a moment of remorse for what they have created. And that article was by Steph Payton. From the National, Tuesday the 13th of February, from the Politics section, Labour Together director apologises for Scotland barge comments. Article by Hamish Morrison. A Labour think tank director has apologised after poorly judged comments about sending people smuggling gangs on a barge to Scotland. Josh Simons, director of the influential Keir Starmer-linked Labour Together think tank, came in for fierce criticism after suggesting people smugglers could be put on a barge and shipped up to the north of Scotland. Labour Together holds considerable sway within the party. Its former director, Morgan McSweeney, is now Starmer's key election strategist. Simons drew ire when speaking on LBC Monday night, when he said his main concern with Rwanda is not actually the human rights implications of it, but his belief the asylum seeker deportation scheme would not work. He added, "I think that while the Conservatives say that they're being both tough in the borders and beefing up the policing and so on, I've seen no real evidence that that is in fact what they are doing, with the kind of commitment and clarity that they need to. I mean, you know, why don't you send the smuggler gangs and put them in a barge that you know has been set aside for the asylum seekers, and then, you know, ship the barge up to the north of Scotland? Who cares?" National contributor Owen Jones said, "This contemptuous way he talks about Scotland, as though being sent there is some sort of gruesome punishment, is another." Now Simons has apologised for his comments, saying, "I love the country." He tweeted, "Following my comments on LBC last night, I apologise for any negative insinuation about Scotland. I'm half Scottish. I love the country and it's where much of my family comes from. It was a poorly judged comment made in jest and doesn't reflect my views or the views of the Labour Party. I was seeking to draw attention to the immorality of housing asylum seekers who are fleeing persecution on a barge while smuggler gangs get off free under the Conservatives. Asylum seekers have been housed on the Bibby Stockholm barge off the Dorset coast. Albanian asylum seeker Leonard Faruku died of a suspected suicide on the barge last year. MPs from the Cross-Party Home Affairs Committee and Joint Committee on Human Rights have raised concerns that cramped, overcrowded conditions on the barge are damaging the mental health of people kept there by the government. Scottish Labour have attempted to distance themselves from Simon's comments, calling them ludicrous. A party spokesperson said, "Every party has elements on the fringes that give them moments of cringe. This is a ludicrous comment, and we couldn't be clearer that Josh Simon's views do not represent the Labour Party. People making stupid comments like this are best ignored. Labour will scrap the Tories' immoral and unworkable Rwanda plan and tackle criminal gangs." And that report was by Hamish Morrison. From the National, Tuesday the 13th of February, from the news section, LBC, "Put smuggler gangs on barge and send them to Scotland," says Labour think tank director. Article by Adam Robertson. The director of the Labour Together think tank and ally of Keir Starmer has suggested that smuggler gangs should be put in a barge and sent to Scotland. Speaking to LBC, Josh Simons was critical of the UK government's Rwanda plan and spoke about his own solution for the small boats crisis. It comes after a key parliamentary committee said the government's plan to send some asylum seekers to Rwanda is fundamentally incompatible with the UK's human rights safeguards. Simon said, "My main concern with Rwanda is not actually the human rights implications of it and the focus of this report. My main concern is that it's a complete waste of money and it won't work. It won't stop the boats." "That was the thing that Rishi," Sunak said. "Judge me by stop the boats. He's failed. He keeps failing and meanwhile he's spending £8 million a day and so far 400 million quid. So my problem with Rwanda is it won't work." Simons then went on to say that this begged the question of what the solution to the issues facing the government were. "I think that while the Conservatives say that they're being tough on the borders and beefing up the policing and so on, I've seen no real evidence that that is in fact what they are doing, with the kind of commitment and clarity that they need to. I mean, you know, why don't you send the smuggler gangs and put them in the barge that you know has been set aside for the asylum seekers and then, you know, ship the barge up to the north of Scotland? Who cares?" The comments were met with criticism in social media, with journalist and National contributor Owen Jones commenting, The fact he expresses no moral objection to deporting desperate people to Rwanda is one thing. The contemptuous way he talks about Scotland as though being sent there is some sort of gruesome punishment is another. These are the new masters of the Labour Party, everyone. Elsewhere, broadcaster India Willoughby said, "You seem to be saying being in Scotland is a punishment, Josh." Tut, tut. And that article was by Adam Robertson. From The National, Tuesday the 13th of February, from the news section, Scottish weather. Scottish Environmental Protection Agency issues several flood warnings. Report by Adam Robertson. A number of flood warnings have been issued for parts of Scotland as one council warned people to remain vigilant. According to the Met Office, the weather will turn a little bit more unsettled more widely across the UK, with temperatures in Scotland to stay in single figures until at least Tuesday. The Scottish Environment Protection Agency, SEPA, has issued a number of flood alerts and the more severe flood warnings for various parts of Scotland. Flood alerts are currently in place for the following areas: Aberdeenshire and Aberdeen City, Dumfries and Galloway, Findhorn near Moray and Speyside, Orkney, Western Isles, Argyll and Bute, Ayrshire and Arran, Caithness and Sutherland, Dundee and Angus, Easter Ross and Great Glen, Fife, Shetland, Skye and Lough Arbour, West Central Scotland, Wester Ross. Meanwhile, the more severe flood warning alert is in place in these areas: Stonehaven, Inner Wigtown Bay, Nith Tidal, Spey Viaduct to Spey Bay, Churchill Barriers, St Margaret's Hope, Longhope and Hoy, Sandy, Westray, Ardmore to Lough Carnan, Bailshear, Stornoway. In a post on its Twitter/X account, Aberdeenshire Council warned people to expect high tides. It said, "An updated flood warning has been issued for Stonehaven. A combination of high tides and prevailing weather conditions means that flooding from the sea is expected to affect low-lying land, roads and properties along the coast in Stonehaven. Wave overtopping is expected around Cowie Boaty Row. Large waves and flooding impacts are expected. The greatest risk is around the time of high tide today, Tuesday, February the 13th, at 4 p.m. Remain vigilant and remember, it is your responsibility to take actions which help protect yourself and your property. Advice and information is also available through Floodline on 0345 988 1188. And that article was written by Adam Robertson.
The National, recorded on Wednesday, 14th of February 2024. The Culture section, exclusive. London's first Scottish shop runs out of tenants in Iron Brew on opening weekend, by Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. A new shop in London which sells Scottish scran ran out of tenants in Iron Brew in its opening weekend. Greg Boyd, the founder of Old Hag, opened his new store, The Shop, in Angel in London last Friday. Originally from Kirkintilloch, Boyd previously spoke with The National about how he had first worked as an economist before his interest in food and drink led to a desire to set up his new business. It stocks a wide range of classic Scottish produce, with everything on sale coming from north of the border, including cheese from Inverness to Mull, smoked fish from East Newark, as well as beer and charcuterie from Edinburgh. Speaking to The National following the opening, Boyd said, "We ran out of tenants on Saturday night. We had 3 kegs and we sold all the cans as well, so that was good news and quite funny. We also ran out of all the Iron Brew and Tatty scones and sold out of the food each day. I think we served 400 customers each day. A lot of people came through and it was really busy with loads of nice customers. Some people had travelled from Kent and even further than that to get some stuff they hadn't had for a long time. A lot of people were sharing their love for the shop and the idea of it. Some of them had been living for 40 years in London and hadn't had anything like it, so they were very pleased." Prior to opening The Shop, Boyd operated a delivery service for people looking to get their share of haggis, neeps and tatties while living in London. On the new business, he previously told The National,
I want to give suppliers a chance around Scotland which nobody seems to know about, but I know are brilliant. By Adam Robertson.
The National. Recorded on Tuesday, 13th of February, 2024. The Culture Section. Exclusive. Scottish writer Josephine Tay to be honoured on Women's Memorial Map. By Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. A Scottish crime writer is to become the 750th woman on a map displaying memorials to famous women across Scotland. Josephine Tay, whose real name was Elizabeth McIntosh, was the daughter of a fruiterer from Inverness, and today, February 13, marks the anniversary of her death in 1952. She wrote a number of successful crime novels, including A Shilling for Candles, upon which Alfred Hitchcock based his 1937 film Young and Innocent. Meanwhile, her mystery novel, The Daughter of Time, has featured in a number of prestigious lists, with BBC Radio 4's A Good Read describing it as one of the most important books ever written. In 2022, a commemorative blue plaque was installed in Castle Street in Inverness at the site of Tay's family shop and business, putting Tay on the map. Speaking to The National, Alison Taylor McCall, admin of the Mapping Memorials to Women in Scotland, said that marking Tay's memorial was an important step. The map itself can be found here, womenofscotland.org.uk. The project is a joint venture between Women's History Scotland and Glasgow Women's Library and features more than 1,000 memorials which can be found across Scotland. However, Tay will become the 750th woman on the list, as many of those featured have more than one memorial dedicated to them. It's not an academic resource, it's a public information resource, says McCall. It's a way to get people interested. You'll quite often see something when you're out and about, but not know the full story behind it all, so this is a series of little stories, as it were. Some people in the list are extremely famous, but a lot of them are women who might have done something small but interesting in their local area. It might be a woman who was a church organist for 40 years, who has some kind of memorial tour, so that there's a huge range, although most people are interested in witches and suffragettes. It's also a way of pushing something like women in science, and their stories tend to be ones that people just haven't heard. A history of crime writing. Scotland has a rich history when it comes to crime writing and is still recognised across the world for its work today. McCall explains that she wants to ensure that everybody knows who Tay is and that there is still a way to go before she gets the recognition she deserves. She says it's important to cover the whole country, and obviously Josephine Tay is in Inverness. There's been lots of interest in her since her biography, written by Jennifer Morag Henderson, was released in 2015. We're wanting to add a bit more information, so if the people see the plaque, or now they know where it is, then they can go and visit it if they want. By Adam Robertson.
The National, recorded on Wednesday, 14th of February 2024. The Culture Section. Protest at Scottish cinema as Tiger Woods' firm looks to shut it down. By Daniel Van Rieren. A Scottish cinema saw its busiest weekend matinee in a very long time, according to a protest organiser. He said residents, students and other supporters showed up en masse throughout the day to show their support for the new Picture House cinema in St Andrews. The 92-year-old Picture House, the university town's only cinema, has been purchased by a US company looking to transform the venue and create a premium sports and entertainment facility. American superstars Tiger Woods and Justin Timberlake are shareholders of US-based Nexus Luxury Collection, who announced the plans in October. It already operates in New York. The company has confirmed it is moving forward despite community backlash. Ash Johan Curry Machado, 22, one of the event organisers and the president of the St Andrews Film Society, said that he set out to prove to the cinema owners in Fife Council that New Picture House, as it is, has a future. Let's show our love, appreciation and commitment by filling those seats and making a statement. St Andrews deserves its cinematic heartbeat and we're here to make sure it thrives, an advertisement from the organisers said. According to Curry Machado, a huge group of people gathered outside the cinema at 1:30 p.m. when it opened on Sunday, and by 5 p.m, he said huge queues of moviegoers were waiting for tickets. Everyone was having a good time and showing exactly why the cinema matters to people. The community really showed that the cinema is crucial to them and they can't bear to see it go, he said. The cinema's managing director, David Morris, who was not at the event, said that occupancy rates were still less than 20%. We'd like to thank all those who attended the cinema on Sunday. However, despite the concerted effort to fill every seat, we recorded an occupancy rate of less than 1 in 5 seats taken up, 18.5%, he said. While positive and greater than our current occupancy of under 10%, this really serves to illustrate the challenge not only to our cinema, but also to the sector as a whole. He continued, the cinema has not been viable for the past number of years, a situation which the owners simply cannot continue to manage without significant new investment. This intervention by T-Squared not only allows a cinema offering to be retained for the town, but also preserves the building itself. Curry Machado has been at the forefront of campaign efforts to save New Picture House from closure or redevelopment since the redevelopment was announced last autumn. His online change.org petition has garnered more than 11,700 signatures to date. Sunday's show of support was the latest effort to keep the cinema as it is for St Andrews, and Curry Machado still believes there is hope for his beloved Picture House. The wealth of evidence we got about what people genuinely think and feel about this redevelopment is absolutely enough to send to Fife Council, Curry Machado concluded. I think we have a strong case in our hands to fight the development plans. It's very evident that people don't want this to happen, and it would only serve to drive people out of St Andrews as opposed to attracting more people, which is what the plans are supposed to be doing. He continued, I think we can prove to them that approving development plans would be very counterintuitive to the benefit of St Andrews. By Danielle Van Wienen.
The National Politics on Wednesday, the 14th of February. Anasawa grilled on Scottish independence referendum. An article written by Adam Robertson. Anasawa has been accused of offering nothing to independent supporters as he was grilled on a second referendum in an interview with STV. The Scottish Labour leader was asked about a number of topics ahead of the general election, which is expected later this year. Speaking to STV, Mr Sawa was asked by host John Mackay under what circumstances a Labour government would offer a second independence referendum. Mr Sawa replied, well, a couple of things. One is, it's Nicola Sturgeon that previously said that they have to build a settled will for independence. Hamza Yousaf then, in the leadership election and since, has talked about building a settled will here in Scotland. There is no settled will. They've previously talked about a 60% support for independence. Mr Sawa's comments come after a recent Ipsos poll suggested that support for yes is sitting at 53%, while we also told how new polling from Find Out Now for the Alba Party put yes in the lead by 4 points on 52%. The Scottish Labour leader added that he was making a different appeal to voters and continued, if you look at what Nicola Sturgeon and Alex Salmond did in the run-up to 2007, they didn't somehow change their position on the constitution. They recognised that the vast majority of people didn't support their constitutional position. But they said directly to people, you may disagree with us on the ultimate constitutional destination, but let us, through good government and competence, try and persuade you. Now, they've failed in that regard, with every institution now being weaker after 17 years of an SNP government. So I'm saying directly to people, I don't support independence, I don't support a referendum, but my goodness, do I recognise why you want to run a million miles away from this rotten Tory government. Asked explicitly if a Labour government might allow a second referendum on independence, Mr Sawa said, no. No, not at all. We have to demonstrate through good government that we can make the UK government work in the interests of people here in Scotland. And I think people will want to give an incoming UK Labour government that chance to deliver that change. And then I actually think people will want change come that election in 2026. But let me be really clear. We may ultimately disagree on the final destination for Scotland, but on this part of the journey, we all agree we need change. So let's work together, deliver that change, and allow us to demonstrate that we can have a government across the UK and here in Scotland that can work in the interests of everybody across our country, and therefore demonstrate that politics can work, rather than having to go down that route being suggested by the SNP. Reacting to the interview on X, formerly known as Twitter, SNP MP Pete Wishart commented, Anasawa again on Scotland Tonight, saying he will offer nothing to independent supporters other than to try and turn them into good unionists. Labour is a hard unionist party. An article written by Adam Robertson. The National News on Wednesday, the 14th of February. New Calmag ferry, the Glensannox, begins sea trials after a six-year delay. An article written by James Walker. The Glensannox, one of the delayed ferries being built at Ferguson Marine, has left its shipyard berth in order to begin sea trials. The ferry, which will one day take passengers to and from Arran, left the Port Glasgow yard on Tuesday, heading to a nearby dry dock. It's expected to begin longer voyages up and down the Clyde on Wednesday and Thursday. The beginning of the manufacturer's sea trials marks an important milestone for the project to build two new ferries for Calmac's fleet. Costs for the Glensannox and sister ship, the Glen Rosa, have more than tripled to at least £360 million, and they're expected to be delivered around 6 years late. Further tests will need to take place before the ferry, which has capacity for 852 passengers, can begin serving the island route. It remains unclear when the Glensannox will be handed over to its owners, as earlier this month, the chief executive of Ferguson Marine said that there had been delays in installing parts of the ship's liquefied natural gas system. Both ships were designed to be dual fuel, running on both liquefied natural gas and traditional bunker fuel in order to keep emissions down. But David Tideman told MSPs the delays had forced the shipyard to bring in an alternative supplier. The Scottish Government has previously said all systems, including the liquefied natural gas propulsion, will need to be completed before the ferry-owning agency CMAL, or Caledonian Maritime Assets Limited, can take delivery. Responding to news of the sea trials, Chief Executive of ferry operator Calmag, Robbie Drummond, said the Glensannox would be one of several vessels joining the fleet in the coming years. He said, "We are very much looking forward to welcoming the Glensannox into the Calmac fleet. She will provide much-needed resilience to the Arran community and will be the first of the six large vessels and 10 small vessels joining us over the next 5 years." Gary Cook, senior organiser at the GMB trade union, said that the government should continue to invest in the nationalised shipyard by ordering smaller vessels at Ferguson Marine. He said, "No one, apart from the islanders who have waited far too long, want these two ferries completed more than the workers. They have been blameless throughout this work and their skill and commitment is beyond question, and they now want to ensure taxpayers begin to get value for money from their yard. That depends on securing a pipeline of work, starting with the small ferries. It makes no sense for a private operator to profit from the investment that has gone into this shipyard after all the pain that has been endured over the current contracts." An article written by James Walker. The National, Politics, on Wednesday, the 14th of February. Reversal of devolution is just as possible as Brexit, warns expert. An exclusive article written by Steph Braun. An expert has warned the future of devolution in Scotland could come under threat if efforts are not made to bridge gaps between Edinburgh and the rest of the nation. David Vampa, senior lecturer in territorial politics at the University of Edinburgh, conducted a survey with Delta Poll, which revealed while Scottish and Welsh people regard devolution as generally beneficial for their respective nations, a much smaller share see it as a good thing for their local communities. It also found overwhelming majorities of Scots and Welsh respondents viewed Edinburgh and Cardiff as the main winners of devolution. Monsieur Vampa, a co-director of the university's Centre on Constitutional Change, said his findings suggest if action is not taken to deal with this, devolution may be exposed to future challenges to its legitimacy and possibly its very existence. He told The National, "It is not impossible to imagine devolution being reversed when we saw during the European referendum what can happen when communities feel brushed aside." Monsieur Vampa said, "I think in the long term that the future of devolution could become a political issue. 10 years ago, we might have said it was impossible for the UK to leave the EU, and then that has happened. In theory, nothing prevents Westminster from abolishing devolved institutions, and if there's a big movement of people in the peripheries of Scotland and Wales who think increasingly the government in Edinburgh or Cardiff doesn't address their needs or doesn't bring any benefits to local communities, it might be something that could happen." If people perceive their local communities are not getting benefits, plus they perceive others are benefiting more, that can trigger some dynamics we saw in the EU referendum against London. I'm not saying these tensions alone led to Brexit, but we all know there's been a lot of anti-London, anti-establishment feeling. The survey conducted in December found 57% of respondents from Scotland agree or strongly agree devolution has benefited their nation, while 65% perceive Edinburgh as benefiting significantly. However, when asked whether devolution has benefited their local communities, the share of positive views in Scotland shrank to 43%. Monsieur Vampa wrote in a blog post, "Clearly there is a diffuse feeling that devolution aimed at addressing territorial disparities in the UK may have contributed to creating new territorial divisions." After the EU referendum, it became apparent that diffuse perceptions of being left behind or disadvantaged compared to other places may produce a backlash capable of subverting established institutional and constitutional equilibria. The perception that local Scottish communities benefit less from devolution than Edinburgh does was present among supporters of different political parties. According to the study, SNP voters see devolution as almost equally beneficial for Scotland as a whole and for Edinburgh, but only 66% of them regard the existence of a Scottish Parliament and its government as positive for their local communities. For Labour voters, 54% of them believe devolution has been good for Scotland overall, but they still see a significant gap between how it has benefited the capital and local communities. For Conservative voters, the survey suggested that just over a fifth believe devolution has been positive for the nation, but only 11% think it has benefited their local area. Monsieur Vampa said this should serve as a warning to politicians and policymakers that devolution could easily be used as a political weapon. He said he's planning to look more deeply into the data, but said from initial findings it's clear that even those living in Scotland's largest city of Glasgow feel disadvantaged compared to those in Edinburgh. He said, "From my preliminary data, it seems there is a similar feeling from Glasgow, a feeling of being disadvantaged. I also looked at economic data over time in Scotland, and what you see is that economically Edinburgh, relative to the economic development of the rest of Scotland, has benefited more, and that gap has increased. Edinburgh has been seen as the big winner of devolution." He added in his blog, "While addressing or channelling tensions between Westminster and more peripheral parts of the UK, devolved institutions risk recreating new, real or perceived gaps at lower territorial levels. A challenge for the political class of the two devolved nations is to bridge these gaps, or at the very least, to prevent them from expanding or being politicised. Failure to do so might strengthen calls for a reversal of the entire devolution process." An exclusive article written by Steph Braun. The National News on Wednesday, the 14th of February. Schoolgirl dies after an incident at Aberdeen swimming pool. An article written by Laura Pollock. A 10-year-old girl has died after getting into difficulty at a swimming pool in Aberdeen. The incident happened around 8 p.m. on Monday at Northfield swimming pool. On Monday, emergency crews were in attendance at the leisure centre and people were turned away as the centre closed. The girl was taken to Aberdeen Royal Infirmary, where she later died. The death is not being treated as suspicious. A spokesperson for Police Scotland said, "Around 8 p.m. on Monday, February the 12th, we were made aware that a young female had got into difficulty in a swimming pool in Aberdeen. Emergency services attended and a 10-year-old girl was taken to hospital, where she later died. Inquiries are ongoing to establish the full circumstances surrounding her death, which is not being treated as suspicious." SNP MP for Aberdeen South, Stephen Flynn, posted in reaction to the news, "Such terribly sad news. My heart goes out to all her family and friends. Can't imagine the pain they must be feeling." A spokesperson for Sport Aberdeen said, following the update from Police Scotland, our thoughts are with the family and friends of the young girl who died and with everyone affected at this difficult time. We continue to work closely with the relevant authorities. Inquiries are ongoing and the venue remains closed until further notice. An article written by Laura Pollock. The National News on Wednesday, the 14th of February. ScotRail provides an update on the Far North Line following significant damage. An article written by Adam Robertson. ScotRail has provided an update on a key line which remains closed as passengers are set to face more disruption. Network Rail closed the line between Brora and Helmsdale earlier this week after significant damage was identified on the line's sea defences. Passengers have been subject to delays, cancellations and alterations as a result, and ScotRail has provided alternative transport to those affected. Network Rail hoped to reopen the Wick to Inverness line on Wednesday, but pictures shared on social media show further damage to the defences has been found at Lothbeg. ScotRail has now confirmed that a number of services throughout the morning and afternoon will terminate at Laoghaire and Invergordon. Journeys are expected to be affected until around 6 p.m. today, while engineers work to repair the new damage. A statement from Network Rail said, "We've begun repairs on the railway's sea defences at Lothbeg, between Brora and Helmsdale on the Far North Line. Unfortunately, further damage was discovered when the team arrived, meaning the line won't reopen on Wednesday as expected." Sharing the images, it said, "As you can see, machinery and the initial delivery of rock armour have arrived. We're working between high tides to repair the damage. We'll share another update on Wednesday with more robust timescales for the railway to reopen." A statement from ScotRail added, "The line between Brora and Helmsdale remains closed, but works have been ongoing since yesterday to repair the damage to the sea defences." An article written by Adam Robertson. The National News on Wednesday, the 14th of February. Scottish firm plays key role in a search for Amelia Earhart's lost plane. An article written by Ross Hunter. A Scottish tech company is playing a key role in the search for Amelia Earhart's missing aeroplane. The famous American pilot disappeared alongside her navigator, Fred Noonan, while attempting to become the first woman to complete a circumnavigational flight around the world in 1937. Investigators believe that the plane disappeared somewhere over the Pacific Ocean. Now, after a 90-day mission at sea, American marine robotics firm Deep Sea Vision claims to have found the Lockheed Electra aircraft on the ocean floor. Specialist at Scottish company Claris Networks Group provided low Earth orbit satellite technology for the mission, allowing the team to access high-speed internet on their search vessel. Until now, it had not been possible to access high-speed internet so far out in the Pacific Ocean. Deep Sea Vision has released a sonar imagery of what they believe to be Ms. Earhart's plane, which was found using an autonomous underwater drone. The drone, nicknamed Miss Millie, helped the company search more than 5,200 square miles of ocean, reaching depths of 6 kilometres and staying underwater for up to 36 hours. High-speed internet allowed Deep Sea Vision's 16-person crew to transmit and manage the sonar data collected by Miss Millie, as well as facilitating video calls back to shore. Tony Romeo, the chief executive of Deep Sea Vision, said the Scottish company's work made a huge difference. He said, "Our search mission took us to one of the most remote oceans in the world, but working with Claris, we were able to maintain super-fast connectivity. This was critical to our mission, allowing us to handle the massive amounts of data sent by our marine robotics and to FaceTime with my 6-year-old daughter back home, who also had plenty of exciting things to show me. We've only made the sonar discovery at the tail end of our expedition, so having fast connectivity had a huge impact on keeping crew morale high and allowing us to communicate with support teams back on shore. We are partnering with Claris for our future search missions, including our return to investigate the site further, hopefully bringing closure to the legacy of an aviation pioneer. Deep Sea Vision said they believe they are one step away from bringing closure to the mystery of Amelia Earhart's disappearance. However, they're keeping all information, including the exact location of what they believe to be the crash site, strictly confidential. The Director of Maritime and Energy at Claris Networks Group, Chris Schonhut, said he was proud to play his part at solving the mystery. The enormity of Deep Sea Vision's mission demonstrates the sheer power of advanced satellite connectivity, allowing the team to search the largest and deepest ocean as a world first, he said. By installing low Earth orbit satellite internet on the search vessel, Claris used Starlink Maritime to deliver superfast connectivity to the middle of the Pacific Ocean, halfway between Hawaii and Australia, where it would have otherwise been impossible. This advanced satellite connectivity can handle huge amounts of data produced by advanced marine robotics, as well as supporting the 16-person crew on their three-month mission. We are proud to continue to support Deep Sea Vision, providing reliable and fast connectivity for their pioneering missions. Deep Sea Vision says the aircraft sits at a depth of around 16,400 feet. However, while the sonar images have intrigued some archaeologists, others say it's too early to know if the image really does show Ms. Earhart's aircraft. An article written by Ross Hunter.
This is from The National on Thursday, 15th February 2024. From the comments section. Poll points to historic SNP general election win. Can we trust it? By James Kelly. If the latest poll from Find Out Now is correct, that the SNP are on course to retain 40 seats at the UK general election, it would arguably be the greatest achievement in the party's history. Although it would fall short of the 56 seats won in 2015 or the 48 seats won in 2019, it would be a landslide triumph secured in infinitely more challenging circumstances, without the stardust of Nicola Sturgeon's leadership and without the assistance of Labour looking like no-hopers. Indeed, the poll suggests Labour would win the vast majority of seats in England to claim a victory of utterly unprecedented proportions, meaning the SNP would have succeeded in bucking an unseemingly unstoppable Britain-wide trend. Hamza Yousaf's troops would still control more than two-thirds of Scottish seats at Westminster, a proportion roughly on a par with what Labour secured across the UK in 1997 and 2001, when Tony Blair was at the height of his powers. It's true the SNP would lose their prized status as the third largest party in the Commons, which might cost Stephen Flynn his two questions at PMQs every week. But that would not be seen as a failure, because it would be due to the Liberal Democrats surging to a projected 53 seats, a level at which it's almost, but admittedly not quite, arithmetically impossible for any Scotland-only party to outnumber them. A London commentariat, eagerly waiting to pronounce Scotland's independence dead, would instead be forced to grudgingly admit that the cause lives on. But are Find Out Now's numbers actually plausible? Some will say they fail the smell test, if only because the projected number of seats for the Conservatives throughout Britain is just 80. Which is not only far below the worst Tory result in living memory, but also poorer than most people can seriously visualise happening. But it's worth recalling that really big landslides, even when they're foreseen, can often turn out to be more extreme than the predictions. By slumping to 165 seats under John Major in 1997, the Tories had found themselves beneath the lower bound of pre-election expectations, and few people were able to imagine the Canadian Conservatives plummeting from 156 seats to just 2, until it actually happened in 1993. So the dramatic nature of Find Out Now's projection for England is not in itself a reason to doubt their positive projection for the SNP in Scotland. It's important to stress, though, that the projection does not come from a conventional full-scale Scottish poll, and therefore the numbers cannot be directly compared to the more regular polling, which has frequently pointed to a very troubling seat tally for the SNP. On the other hand, Find Out Now's numbers do not come from a tiny and meaningless Scottish subsample either. Some 18,000 respondents were interviewed across Britain for the poll, which is roughly 9 times the most typical sample size of a UK poll. That was done to ensure that credible estimates of vote shares could be made at the constituency level in Scotland every bit as much as in England. It must also be remembered that Find Out Now's projection for Scotland is actually bang in line with one particular recent conventional Scottish poll, naming the Ipsos poll, which also had the SNP on course for 40 seats. That was a rare example of a Scottish telephone poll raising hopes that the findings may be more accurate than online polls, showing the SNP slumping to well under 30 seats, sometimes well under 20. But the reality is that the positive polls for the SNP do not actually differ all that much from the negative polls in terms of the popular vote. Hamza Yousaf finds himself firmly in the scary zone where just a few percentage points in either direction will be massively magnified by the first-past-the-post voting system and have huge consequences in terms of seats. In that sense, Find Out Now's projection does not change what we already knew, which is that the SNP could be heading for an exceptionally good or exceptionally poor general election result, or any shade of grey in between, depending on which pollster's methodology turns out to be the most accurate. That article was by James Kelly.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Q and Review. Tell your friends about our service.